Welcome to the 63rd episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Tiffany Chad.
Welcome to the podcast that has never, to our knowledge, been accused of being a mood hoover.
Yeah, and we are also going to be the only media outlet, the only cricket media outlet that is not going to be entirely dominated by KP's new autobiography, we promise.
We're going to have to talk about
luckily out here in Australia, I've been kind of cushioned a little bit from the media frenzy that I hear has been going on over in the UK, where I think it's been quite insane, hasn't it?
It's been quite extraordinary, actually. I mean, it was most obvious when it was actually run on the BBC 6 o'clock news after a story about ISIS and a story about Ebola, and the next story was KP's autobiography. I mean, I guess one thing you can say about it is certainly put cricket,
cricket on the front pages. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're going to make a very conscious attempt not to talk about the allegations. A lot of much cleverer people than ourselves have talked a lot and sort of weighed them on that. I wanted to actually pick out a positive of the whole thing was that KP's interview with Adrian Charles on BBC 5 Live, which was probably the most quoted of all his interviews. There was a lovely moment where he stepped away from the sniping and he stepped away from the allegations and the bullying and stuff. And he started reminiscing about the good times. And he talked about how when he bats, he feels freer than at any other point in his life. And I thought, actually, that line pretty much sums up what made KP special for me as a batsman. It was that he played in an uninhibited fashion that's actually just not very English. And he started, and he was like, he was so excited to be talking about the first time he played the reverse hit. He was talking about that innings to secure the Ashes at the Oval. And you thought, actually, when all the dust has settled on this, let's just hope that those are the times we end up looking back on those special, special innings. And it was great to feel that he is still able to take a lot of joy in those achievements after all the other unfortunate stuff that's gone on.
Well, it's one of the problems of these sort of situations that the kind of legacy becomes so tainted that we just remember KP, the person who wrote the autobiography and slagged off everyone in the English setup, rather than KP, the batsman who, you know, brought us quite a lot of joy one way or other through the years. As I say, I've luckily been sort of slightly out of the real eye of the storm when it's come to KP. But what I have been doing over here very diligently in Sydney is trying to sort of acclimatise to the Australian cricket season, which is of course just kicking off at the moment. I literally acclimatized a couple of weeks ago, or kind of completely failed to acclimatize when I was batting in 35 degree heat. Made a few runs, also got horrible heat stroke. We were going to record this podcast that evening. I just couldn't. I was delirious. It was not very pleasant for anyone.
Talk me through heat stroke. Were you what you were sort of you were sick?
It just drains you. I was sick. It just absolutely drains you to the extent that you just can't move. And I had a bit of a temperature, a bit of a fever. To be honest, I scored 40, which was probably such a shock to the system that I'd actually scored some runs, and that was probably the kind of the greatest cause behind it. But the other thing, as well as playing, that I've been doing is sort of trying to, I suppose, sort of mug up on the Australian domestic game, and I haven't actually been to any games yet this season. But my eye was caught by a particular match up at the North Sydney Oval, which happened yesterday. And the ground, it seems from this game, is a bit of a batsman's paradise. So Queensland were playing Tasmania in a one-day game, and during this one-day game, there were 800 runs scored for the loss of only 4 wickets. There are a whole number of records, one of which was there was the first ever double century in Australian domestic limited overs cricket, scored by a chap called Ben Bunk for Tasmania, who scored 229 not out. And I suddenly realised when I was thinking about that, if you scored 229 not out in 50 overs, it means that just one of the two batsmen is scoring at a rate of 4 an over to start off with, which actually is sort of just quite extraordinary. It wasn't enough. Queensland chased down the total of 398 for 1 with an astonishing 16 balls left. And whilst I'm no sucker for these kind of batsman-dominated games, and by the way, all 4 of the openers scored a century, which has to be another kind of record. Actually, this sounds like fun in terms of cricket, so it's sort of whetted my appetite for the rest of the season.
You do wonder where we go with this, don't you? You think, I mean, that's obviously record-breaking, but you think, how much can we push this? I mean, when are you going to get the first triple centurion in a one-day game? I mean,
when I don't get heat stroke, yeah.
That's going to happen, is it? Oh, excellent.
Yeah, exactly. For the ABC team, opening the bat. passing. There we go. Anyway, moving on from idyllic happenings in Sydney, what else have you been has caught your attention in the cricket world?
Well, there's been this big chucking clamp down, and I think people are obviously quite split on it. I think there's a sense that it's quite sad to be losing, potentially, from the game, players as exciting as Syed Ajmal and Sunil Narine. But at the same time, you know, there are rules for a reason. If they are chucking, then it's fair. But I think the really worrying aspect of this story, and George De Bell did a brilliant article on Crick Info about this, looking at how the way the ICC's testing process for chucking is being brought into question, and they're being very unopen about it. They're not really revealing how it works. And I think what's worse than people being caught and accused is the fact that they're being caught and accused by a system that is now going to be doubted, and it's going to add an element of uncertainty. It's going to add an element of unfairness. You know, if teams are going to the World Cup with bowlers suspended, possibly on false grounds, and it's just, it kind of comes down to more of this thing with, you know, so much of cricket news being dominated by stuff that actually isn't really cricket. You know,
ongoing
thing where we're reading Cricket Info and finding almost nothing about the game. You know, the games being played. It's all about these controversies.
A little while ago, we reviewed Michael Holding's book, No Holding Back, and he had some interesting things to say about the whole chucking system and the way that it was measured and everything like that, and the move towards a system that's basically empirical. So it's not about, you know, an umpire disliking a particular player. It's just that it's either, you know, they are chucking or they aren't. And so this is sort of exactly the whole problem with this, is that if it turns into something that becomes sort of political and acrimonious, that's when it starts snowballing into a real problem, I think.
So from one crisis to another, and this is this is almost a traditional crisis, isn't it? It's when we come back to one, you've been upset by the latest crisis in the West Indies.
Well, yeah, I mean, as much as anything, because on this podcast, we spend a lot of time being you spend a lot of time being optimistic about the Windies. You love the Windies, and you know,
yeah.
and about I reckon I didn't go through and count it up, but you know, the number of players who have come through who you've said, oh, they're the next, you know, Curly Ambrose, or oh, they're the next Lara, you know, whatever. Oh, they've now got a brilliant team spirit. Oh, they've now made it up with their administration and it's all happy and everything like that. And it kind of, you know, we've had all of these sort of dawns, whether they've been false dawns or not, who knows, but kind of miniature dawns. But this new situation just seems absolutely apocalyptic. The fact that there has been such a breakdown between the administration and the players that they can't even play a game of cricket and they've actually had to draw out of a tour is, I mean, that's just sort of the be all and end all, isn't it?
And particularly amateurish, isn't it? The whole thing. I mean, these relations, the way they're being conducted. And I think what it makes you realise is that how is talent going to thrive in this system? You know, it's just, there's a chaos to it that, that they just don't seem to be able to address.
And there are two, I mean, as far as I can tell, there are two. I mean, the whole situation is sad, but there are two particularly sad things. One of which is the commercial reality is that pulling out of a tour in India loses you in an awful lot of money. And I just saw just a few minutes ago, actually, a new article on Crick Info about the fact that the BCCI are going to, well, the kind of fine to the West Indies will be absolutely massive and will just set them back by years. The other quite unfortunate thing, actually, is that the Sri Lankans have stepped in so rapidly, because it's almost as if, you know, the West Indies are basically just completely replaceable and obsolete. You know, they can withdraw and then the Sri Lankans can step straight in.
I think it is really worrying, because I think there's been an ongoing fear amongst a lot of us who have sympathy and a lot of affection for West Indies cricket that they might well slip out of the top tier of cricket. You know, they might just stop competing, frankly, with the top teams. And I think, you know, something like this brings that a lot closer.
From the archives, and this episode, Andy is going to take us through the shot that gave this podcast its name, the reverse sweep.
Playing for the Rothmans Cavaliers against Middlesex at Uxbridge in 1964, Mushtaq Mohammed was being tied down by Fred Titmuss. Mohammed, who'd gone on to captain Pakistan, claims the reverse sweep was his spontaneous invention to play the ball into a vacant area in the field. What I love is that Titmuss instantly complained to the umpire, who calmly replied that there wasn't anything wrong with it. I think what's interesting is that this story kind of illustrates the fact that the reverse sweep has always been about exploiting the field. It's about a field is set up to deal with conventional shots, and it's an invention very much to deal with that. It also shows this an ongoing theme within cricket, I think, that when people invent and try new shots, new deliveries, there's always some people who say, God, that's an act of genius, that's brilliant. And other people, often the bowlers in this case, who see it as a slightly underhand, against the spirit of cricket trick.
I'm actually quite interested that it was as late as 1964, because I've never consciously known what the kind of accepted date for the first reverse sweep was, but I would always have thought that it was, in a sense, it's such an obvious shot that you would have thought that it's been around for a long while. But the fact that Titmuss reacted in that way, the fact that Titmuss was kind of, what on earth's going on, surely this can't be legal, indicates that even if there were people who were playing the shot before, that this was perhaps the moment that it, you know, first people became conscious of it.
I think within cricket there is a lot of myth making around when things were invented, and I think we probably have to take this story even with it. I mean, the story I think is true, but the idea that it was the first, and certainly the idea that it was a spontaneous invention, I think we can take that with a pinch of salt. And I think Mushtaq Mohammed has done very well at promulgating this myth and telling anyone who'll listen that he was the inventor of the reverse sweep.
Yeah,
whereas
sure.
I'm certain there are probably people doing it elsewhere.
Although, having said that, that shot that whoever it was, KP, played the first one where he actually changed from being a right hand
yes.
to a left hander.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one where obviously there is a thing. But yeah, as you say, with something like this, surely at some point someone did something similar.
I think there's a case for saying the reverse sweep is probably the most arrogant shot in cricket. And I think this is one of the things that makes it very compelling for fans. You can't play a reverse sweep without a degree of premeditation. Part of the fun of researching this feature, I've watched quite a few interviews with batsmen discussing it, and that's one thing they're all agreed on. You have to decide, see the ball coming, say, right, I'm going to set myself up for this. And you play one, and it completely asserts your dominance over a bowler. You're saying, I'm so on top of you that I can set up to play this shot before I even know what's coming. There's a nice feature from Glenn Maxwell in this, who talks about he always tries to get one in 2020 games early in an over, because so you do it in an early in the over, and you get in the bowler's head. They're like, God, this batsman's all over me. You know, he's comfortable with this.
But isn't there a sense as well in which it's actually sort of a last resource as well? Because it's something whereby, you know, if conventional shots can't work, then you have to resort, and it's a risky shot, as we've said, then you have to resort to the reverse sweep as the only thing that's actually going to be able to get you some runs.
And funnily enough, those sort of terms, talking about it as a release shot, is kind of how A.B. de Villiers talks about it. And he very much sees, he feels his other shots have failed, he's not being able to penetrate the field, or even actually he's just not timing the ball very well. And he says, right, I'll try it as a release shot to get something going. The other thing that's really interesting about it is that you end up forcing the captain to make a decision, obviously, about how he sets his field up. And if you then adjust the field for the reverse sweep, you do open up gaps for the conventional big shots. And this is something that Maxwell talks about. He says, well, I'll play a reverse sweep to create a couple of gaps elsewhere for, you know, my big slogs over the top, basically, which are his default shots. Now, from my, you know, extensive YouTube research on this, I think it's hard not to come to the conclusion that Owen Morgan is the modern master of this shot. The thing that's absolutely fascinating about watching Morgan play it, in contrast to other players, is he does a lot more than just deflect the ball. He really whips his arms. He gets a lot of power behind it. What I thought was quite funny is when, in an ECB interview, trying to, you know, ask Morgan what his magic was, his trick, he says he didn't think much about it, it's just like eating breakfast. And I like the fact that for what many people is a rare novelty shot, for Morgan it's just a standard part of his armoury. It's not a strange thing to do. But if you think the reverse sweep is special, go on YouTube and check out Morgan's reverse sweep, because this is just a totally improbable, almost anatomy-defying shot where he gets in position to play the reverse sweep, then the ball ends up being not really where he wants it, and he contorts his wrist somehow to play a conventional sweep. It's absolutely staggering, and the kind of thing where I imagine if you're a bowler, you look at that and just think, you know, why do I bother?
But there is something, because there are batsmen who you watch playing the reverse sweep and it's very premeditated. They get into position, they've obviously practiced it, and they go through a motion. And then there are other people like Owen Morgan to whom exactly it does look perfectly natural in the way that he plays it, in the sense that he's not, it's not so premeditated that he then can't react to the shot. As you're saying, it's part of his armoury and he has as much control over it as he does over his other shots, whereas I think a lot of other batsmen don't actually, you know, they go down to play a reverse sweep, and if the ball's not in the right place, they just have to let the ball hit them. They can just play one shot. They're not actually batting control of the shot.
And I think that's right. I think it's worth noting that I think for the majority of batsmen in international cricket today, it's still a real gamble of a shot. It's not something they're as comfortable doing. There's been a fascinating evolution with it, that previously you would only ever play a reverse sweep to a spinner. You know, the pace of the ball just seemed to make that necessary. But increasingly, you're seeing people doing it to seamers. And it does require a lot of bravery, because if you see people doing that, to make the shot work, you really have to get your head in behind the ball, which, you know, if you're trying to reverse sweep Dale Steyn, you know, you are taking considerable risk.
Yeah, you just wouldn't, would you? You just really, really wouldn't.
No. I have to say, the only time I ever play the reverse sweep is during games of park cricket with a tennis ball, where ultimately...
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Ultimately, the level of, you know, it can only go wrong in very limited ways. Aside from the fact that I think if I tried it in club cricket, the level of barracking you would get would just, you know, not.
Oh, you do. I mean, you do just instantly look like an idiot.
Yeah.
If you try. So on your great tour of YouTube, when you were researching this, there must have been some good films of it just going wrong for people.
Well, this is it. I mean, all batting is about this balance of risk and reward, isn't it? But the reverse sweep has that very extreme example of this. There's a hilarious one where Paul Adams, who we all remember as the frog in the blender, from South Africa, not much of a batsman, and he plays this reverse sweep to Shane Warne and edges straight behind the keeper. And what makes this shot more hilarious is that, you know, Adams is obviously not a natural batsman. Shane Warne is absolutely, and Shane Warne cannot stop laughing. It's one of the oddest things. Shane Warne is just in sheer hysterics. He can't control himself. He thinks the very idea of Adams trying to reverse it is just the most hilarious thing he's ever seen. So that's quite fun. Although ultimately that wasn't a particularly significant game. The real reverse sweep cock-up that has a huge role in English cricketing history, actually, was Mike Gatting in the 1987 World Cup final. England were on track to win this final. 135 for 2 off 31 overs, chasing 254. And Gatting attempts to reverse sweep Alan Border's first delivery. It's on leg stump, and he somehow, even watching it a few times, it's quite hard to work out exactly what happens. He somehow manages to top edge it onto his own shoulder, and it loops to the keeper. And this is the deciding point in the game. At that point, Australia sort of take over and come up. And it feels like possibly Gatting was trying to get at his opposite number, make a statement against his captain, and it goes disastrously wrong. And I think Wisden puts it rather nicely, where it describes it as a moment too crass to contemplate.
I mean, it is one of those shots where when you pull it off, it can do all those things you've talked about. It can make the captain think about where his field's going to be. You know, it can be the release shot, and it can, you know, when conventional shots don't work, it can be the one that can get you some runs. But at the same time, it can just reduce professional batsmen to looking like complete fools.
To the review, and this episode we've been reading On Warne by Gideon Hay. I'll leave it to others to describe Hay. The Guardian describes him as the most gifted cricket essayist of his generation. The Times calls him Australia's finest cricket writer.
Now, this book isn't, nor does it purport to be, a biography of Shane Warne. There are certainly a lot of biographical elements to it, and there's certainly a lot that I learned about Warne's biography through it, but it's actually very much an essay, and as the title suggests, on Warne. It's broken up into a number of sections, into five sections, and they all look at different aspects of Warne's life. For instance, there's one section that obviously looks at the art of his spin bowling. There's another one that looks at the men who have influenced him. And one of the structures that Hay has that plays its way out across the book is this idea of the sort of the three ages of Shane Warne. The first one of Warne as the sort of the young bowler who burst onto the scene. The second one of the age of Warne, where he was fundamentally a fairly troubled cricketer one way or other, and when there are the injury crises and the various personal crises that hit him in the late 1990s. And then the third age of Warne, when he was, you know, the Warne of 2005 that we that we all now sort of recognise.
It's a very helpful analysis, actually, because it makes you realise that, you know, Warne will go down as one of the greats, but one of the things that makes him the great is that he did have to have that redemption. He had to have that comeback. You know, in the middle of his career, he was struggling. There was a point of view where, you know, his career almost looked like it would come to a very premature end. And there was this incredible comeback towards the end of his career where his genius and his experience sort of combined, and Hay pulls that together very, very well.
And another thing which I think is very interesting about the book is the way that there's that kind of, and I suppose in a sense that is a biographical element to the book, but the analysis that Hay brings of the Warne phenomenon is something that I haven't ever sort of seen so deeply and so eloquently and so sort of understandably analysed anywhere else. And he comes up with this word, this brilliant word, which is Warnitude. And there's this wonderful statement where he simply says, there was the leg break and then there was the leg break from Shane Warne. And this whole thing about, you know, the Warne phenomenon that grew up, I think this is, you know, is something that is explored throughout the book and is a really sort of fundamental part of it.
But he is brilliant at that aura of Warne, of talking about the fact that when you were playing him as a batsman, batsmen were incapable of separating the reputation from the delivery. And he analyses the pause that Shane Warne would have before he bowled. Mm-hmm. He talks about the fact that it was about letting you wonder what he might bowl. It was an assertion of control. It was saying, you know, I'm in charge here. I'm just going to wait and I'm going to let you start thinking, let you start worrying.
And the other thing that comes across, I think, in this analysis of Warne is exactly how skilled Warne was at all of those parts of the game. He wasn't just someone who, you know, happened to be good at being a leg spinner. He was the person who actually realised how important it was to have that pause and put the doubt into the batsman's mind.
It's a cliche to talk about sport as theatre. But in Warne's case, he revelled in that. It was all theatre. It was all acting. It was all performance.
There's a great little anecdote on the off the field side of things. And apparently, you know, we all have this image of Warne being the kind of beer swilling, cigarette smoking, you know, the one who refuses to do exercise and just turns up and is brilliant. But there's quite an interesting anecdote in the book about once at the end of a game, apparently someone was visiting the dressing room and Warne heard that they were coming, and he just went out and he just begged someone to give him beer and a cigarette, and he sat there in the corner with them. And that was actually the first, no one had actually seen him in the dressing room with a beer and a cigarette before, and he had just done it as part of the whole act. And after that, it sort of then became the ritual that he would do and he would put on.
I think one thing that's very interesting about the book is the way it really defines Warne in terms of his relationships. And I very much enjoyed the analysis of the Shane Warne, Stuart McGill balance, because it was something that always seemed a bit odd that you had two very talented leg spinners coming on at the same time. But what is interesting about this is the way Hay comes at the problem from a lot of different angles. So he's very strong on the stats. So he does analyse how they performed when they bowled together, how they performed when they bowled independently. And then he comes up, it's almost scientific, he kind of has his different hypotheses, he has his different theories, why did they perform the way? And it's just such a methodical and such an impressive analysis. And he comes to a really interesting conclusion, actually, from looking at that relationship, that actually no one has ever fully appreciated how well Warne did in not spin-friendly conditions. You know, this was one of the sort of key things that he comes through, having worked through all the stats and worked through all the theories. And I think it's something about the fact that Hay's writing both has this flair, but he's also just so good on the methodical analysis and working through possible explanations for things.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the, continuing on that, what you're talking about in terms of Hay's writing style, one of the things that's so wonderful and so readable about the book is that there is so much information that is crammed into it one way or other. You know, in order to reach a judgment, he's taking everything from having, you know, met and interviewed people through to the stats, through to, you know, whatever else, and bringing them all together, and through to a huge array of allusion as well. There are quotes that are brought in from all over the place, and Hay doesn't do them in a, you know, it's not to show off. It's because they actually illuminate what's going on, and that's how he used stats as well to illuminate things that are going on.
And I think he gets the tone exactly right in that I don't think there's any question, and Hay's quite open about this, that he is an admirer of Warne. He is deeply impressed with him as a cricketer, and actually, frankly, he's quite complimentary with him as a, on on him as a human being as well. Mm. But he yep. both has, he writes with Warren with affection, but not as an idol. You know, it's not sort of mindless worshipping. I'd say a couple of the interesting things I think, you know, that you learn about Warren. We all know how heavily he was affected by scandals, how heavily his career was affected by scandals at different points. But Hayes, very interesting on how Warren had a remarkable ability to, when he got out on the pitch, just put those things to one side. And Hayes makes the point that actually it's something that a lot of us do. It's a weird thing that, you know, we immerse ourselves in work as an escape from personal troubles. And he was saying, well, actually, Shane Warne was no different. You know, cricket was his work, cricket was his craft. So actually, however many stories were in the tabloids, when he got on the pitch, that would be where he'd hide almost.
So when I propose that we review this book next from the sort of our bucket list, I suppose, of books, Andy wrote back and said, I think that's a great idea. It's the greatest cricket writer of our generation writing about the most interesting cricketer of our generation. And in a sense, that just sums it up. I mean, I think it's certainly one of the finest cricket books I've ever read. And so, yeah, if you haven't, you should.
To the interview, and this episode I spoke to Nigel Walker, one of the co-founders of the independent and irreverent cricket commentary service Guerrilla Cricket, formerly known as Test Match Sofa. Okay, Nigel, thanks for joining us on Reverse Threat Radio. Given the experience you've had now with Test Match Sofa and now Guerrilla Cricket, I wondered what insights you think you've picked up on what makes for really, really good commentary.
Well, I think that good commentary is bringing excitement to the listener. You know, you've got to be able to convey the state of the game to the person who's listening, because we're doing radio, so when people can't see the pictures. So it's really important that you convey a sense of excitement of what's going on the screen, you know, if there's a batting collapse. And bear in mind that we're a biased commentary anyway. I mean, we're English-centric. Mm-hmm. So we like to be able to convey the excitement that people should be feeling about the fact that, you know, for example, this summer when India were collapsing in the last 2-3 tests, it was very exciting. And you have to be able to convey that to the listener, and you want them to enjoy the excitement with you, you know, that kind of thing.
Do you think that's an important part of your appeal as a show, that you have, that you're openly, biased, I suppose, one way, but you know, that you're openly fans? Do you think that's part of the appeal?
Oh, very much so, and I think that's the difference between us and, say, the BBC or Sky. We can be a lot more, we can go a lot more in that direction, and allow, especially with the interaction with the Twitter sphere and stuff. And it does a banter with the opposition as well, especially, you know, playing the Australians over the last few years. We've done a lot of Ashes series now, and we particularly get on with Australians. When they're beating us, they give us a load of jip, and when we're beating them, we likewise give them a load of jip. And I think it adds something to it. It's the whole idea of Test Match Sofa when it originally started was that it was fans watching it on the sofa, and it'd be like with your mates. So if we were a bunch of Australians sitting on the sofa and we were watching cricket and they were beating us, they'd be giving us crap while we were having a few beers on the sofa, and likewise we'd be doing them. So that was the original idea of it, and it's just grown out that way.
And do you think you've got an idea in your head of what a typical Guerrilla Cricket listener looks like? Because I mean, I probably fall into a category of quite a few people where I listen to your show and have done for a long time now. But I do mix it up with other things. So I will listen to Test Match Special sometimes. I will be watching it on TV. So you know, do you think there's a typical listener who kind of will just listen to your show?
I mean, like you, I don't think that's necessarily true. And I think that's the beauty of cricket, and especially Test cricket, because it's a 5-day game. So when I'm not on, I can't always listen. I've got my children, I've got things to do. So I'll follow the cricket in various different ways. Like you, when I'm at home, I'll watch it on Sky, maybe. When I'm out, I'll listen to ourselves on the radio. I might catch TMS if I'm in the car. If I can't get any of those, I follow the ball-by-ball text. And the thing is, when it gets more exciting, you tend to have more of those things on you. I was out doing a meeting when the defence in the last test against Sri Lanka, the sun was going on, and we were having a meeting about Guerrilla Cricket then. And all of us were sitting in the pub, and we were trying to have this meeting, but there was no coverage, and we all had our phones out, and we were watching the text, you know. So I think the beauty of Test cricket is it allows itself to be covered by all these sorts of things, and they're all valid, actually, and they're all very good ways of being able to follow it.
And you're right. I mean, it's hard to stick with something for 5 days, you know, in one form. You've almost got to mix and match. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, you've now done several Ashes series. You've been going for quite a while. And I just wondered, as you said, it started off as a group of friends wanting to do something. I mean, how do you think you've kept it going? Because I just think it's staggeringly impressive, the amount of coverage you've delivered to the quality you've delivered it. You know, what do you think's kept the show going?
Well, that's an odd one, because I think, I mean, we're going to touch on Troubles with a Cricketer later, but I think mainly it's a passion project. I mean, from my personal experience, you know, I have three children. I still play cricket. I've been playing cricket since I was 13. I avid watcher of cricket when I didn't have kids and I was living on my own. And I came to a point where I kind of stopped watching it on the telly because I didn't have the time. And for me, as a passion project, it was an excuse to be able to go and watch cricket again and follow it avidly. And for other people, it's a different reason. But it is a kind of passion. We all wanted to be able to sit there, watch the cricket. And everyone has an opinion about cricket. Like most sports, if you're really into it, you have an opinion. And I think everyone's opinion is valid, which is part of the reason why Twitter is so successful with our show. And so... That's what's kept it going, just the passion to be able to sit there and watch cricket and think, well, you know, this is a reasonable way for... We can explain it well enough that people follow us and listen to us, as we've seen with Test Match Sofa, and hopefully we'll go on with Guerrilla Cricket. So it's there, you know?
Do you think... Have you had a feeling that because, you know, you've just said there, and it's something I'd certainly agree with, that, you know, the people's opinions are valid, especially when, you know, the opinions of people who watch the game a lot and are fans of the game. But do you think, I guess, professional commentators have regarded you as a threat for that reason? Because what you're also sort of saying is you're saying, well, actually, commentary isn't for, you know, the ex-cricketers of this world. It isn't for, you know, it could be something over. Do you feel you've been regarded as a threat in that regard?
Yeah, well, that's a tricky one, because I don't think early on we were, and some people don't see us as a threat. Some people, I mean, the obvious thing to say to the cricket establishment on that score would be, listen, cricket, especially in this country, not necessarily in India and other parts of the world, it's quite niche, really. And to get more and more people involved, if you offer them more and more options to be able to listen to it, then you're going to find more and more people will listen to the thing that they like. And so in that sense, I don't think we should be regarded as a threat. We should be regarded as something to be embraced, so that people can go, well, you know, I don't like the stolid way that the BBC does it. I don't like Aggers, and Beefy annoys me. But these guys over here who have a few drinks and call it as they see it and aren't scared to swear and stuff, like I'm not when I'm watching the telly and some idiot gets himself out in a very stupid way, that's for me. And if the more people you can get in and watch the game, then surely the more successful the game is going to be. So whilst I think some people do see us as a threat, I don't think we should be, really.
So can we move on to your experience with the cricketer? Because I must say that I've sort of understood little bits and pieces of this. But, I mean, what do you think you've learned from the whole experience? Because as far as I can understand it, and please correct me, that it seemed like Test Match Sofa were given a real opportunity to do something with the cricketer, and for various reasons it didn't sort of work out, and that you've ended up deciding that the best path for you guys is to go forward in a sort of new independent form again. I just wondered what your main lessons have been from that whole encounter.
Well, it's a tricky one, because I wasn't involved in negotiations with cricketer. I mean, I started this out with Dan when we originally started Test Match Sofa. I mean, this is all personal opinion stuff, and it can't be quoted. But it can be quoted, but I don't know the truth. I've never spoken to Neil about it at the cricketer. But my own personal feelings on this was that actually they got involved with us, and they weren't actually sure what we were. And then they got a bit scared, like the establishment to a certain degree, that we weren't mainstream enough. And then it didn't really work, because it seemed to me that they didn't want to particularly promote us. And that was their downfall. And of course, it costs money to produce stuff. You can't do it free. The better the team you want, and the higher up the scale you want to get. I mean, I've been working in TV for 15 years, and I've worked for the BBC and all this kind of stuff. And the thing is, production values are what counts when you're doing a show, and it costs money to do production. And I think after 2 years, they hadn't made any money out of it, and they didn't see it going anywhere. But my personal feeling on that was they didn't try to promote it enough, and so they got to the end where they didn't want to do another series because they were throwing money at it and it wasn't going anywhere. And at that point, we decided that, you know, this summer, India versus England was a very, you know, looked like a very exciting series to do. India were on the up, England had just been smashed by the Aussies and were on the down, and it had the potential to be a very exciting series, which in the end it was. I mean, even though we won 3-1, it was still an exciting series. And so we just parted the ways, really. We tried to get our the name Test Match Sofa back off them, but they weren't prepared to sell it back to us, and so we had to go a different way and start our own thing again.
It does seem quite strange, because it's one thing we've sort of talked about before on this podcast, that there have been some interesting moves of people from sort of the cricket, sort of the alternative cricket journalism to the mainstream. So I always think of someone like Jared Kimber, who's very much moved from Cricket with Balls, an independent blog, to being, I mean, I think he's managed to keep his own style to quite an extent with the move to Crick Info. But it does seem to be strange that obviously in that case, you had a very, and still do have a very sort of unique approach to commentary. And obviously the cricketer found something they liked, and then maybe when they got to it, then, as you sort of suggested, got cold feet. I mean, I wonder whether, I mean, you talked about the cost, which I think is a relevant thing, I guess, for anyone trying to do their own thing with this. Do you think it's possible to have a sort of sustainable business model for what you're doing as Guerrilla Cricket? Do you think it's possible to make, you know, make enough money to pay the bills, or even make a profit out of it?
I think there's, I mean, you've got to think you're on the internet, so you've got a worldwide audience. So there's definitely the possibility. I've always believed that it would be sustainable. I don't think it would ever be massively profitable. It's certainly sustainable, but it's a question of getting to a, you know, with all these things on the web, it's a question of getting to a certain amount of listeners so that you can get a certain type of sponsor who's then going to cover your costs. And that's about it. That's where it gets to. And we've talked about this long and hard over the years, and that's where you've got to get to. But yeah, I do think it's sustainable.
Are you surprised that there haven't been similar services to Guerrilla Cricket emerging? I mean, did you expect, when you set it up and when you'd done it for a bit, that did you expect to see competitor services coming out, or?
Well, yes and no. I mean, for precisely the reason that they put money into it and they never made money. I mean, and the fact that cricket, although it's our third national sport, is still seen quite as niche, it's no longer on national broadcast. I mean, you look at the three main sports in England, you've got football, which is obviously massive, rugby, which still, you know, you have the Six Nations, which is on, you know, terrestrial telly, so people can get to watch it, and BT, which a lot of people have BT Live, so they get BT Sport free, and cricket is only on Sky, and you have to get Sky Sports, which makes it expensive. So cricket, I think, whilst the ECB have obviously made cricket more fundable, or, you know, more lucrative by the fact that they've got done a deal with Sky, and therefore they get enough money to keep the sport going, I don't think it reaches the audience that it could do on national telly, and therefore it has a problem and is harder for people to do a thing that we're doing. But if you want to reach the worldwide audience, you've got to spread out and try and do neutral series, which is why we're doing Pakistan and Australia.
And what I find interesting is you've got a really varied team of commentators. And I think one thing that's very interesting, if you compare what you guys do with sort of some of the mainstream broadcasters, is that both in terms of age, gender, ethnicity and whatever, your team is really quite good spread. I mean, how do you sort of decide, oh, I think this person will, you know, make a good job of it on TMS?
that's more down to who you can get, to be honest, when you're doing stuff for free, you know. I mean, we've had people come in and they've stuck around with us for a couple of months and then disappeared off the face of the planet, you know. And other people have stuck around with it for years and years and years, like myself. Hopefully, I mean, Dan's going to come back and do some stuff for the Pakistan-Australia series. You're basically relying on, you know, you're doing stuff for free, so you're relying on people who have a passion about it, who come in and enjoy it. I mean, we picked up this summer, you know, Nestle Boy, for example, was one of our, he's never going to be a commentator, but, you know, he was one of our first ever email stroke Twitter followers when we did Test Match Sofa all the way back in 2009. And he came in a few times this summer and has, you know, has now become kind of a valuable member of the team because he gels with the other people. I mean, it's more to do with how people gel on air, I suppose. You know, you can have someone in and it might be a bit stilted, but if you get someone in and they immediately gel with the rest of the team, as conversation flows, they understand their cricket, they understand where they fit in with the team, then they're always welcome back and you can just add them to the roster. I mean, you have that we have a lot of people who are possibles to come on the show because we have to, especially during in you know, work times during the week, trying to get people to do the show. You like, you have the term people who are committed, and the rest you're trying to get people who've got a bit of time off, who can give you a few hours here and there, because no one's getting paid and you're trying to keep a show going. So I mean, there's a bit of both going on there.
And it seems to me like it's been a very good summer. You've had the England India series very well covered. Exciting that there's now the Pakistan Australia series that's going to get coverage. Is there a master plan now, a sort of where you'd like it to be in 5 years' time, or even, I guess, a couple of years' time?
Well, yeah, I'd like to, you know, think that we're going to be large and everyone's going to be listening to this. You can't plan for too much. I mean, we'd like to think that, I mean, having had the experience with Test Match Sofa, we kind of know what we need to do, the level the show needs to be at, and where we need to get with listeners to be able to get the money in. So I think, you know, that experience has been invaluable. You can kind of cut out all the mess that went on for maybe 2 or 3 years for Test Match Sofa to get to a point where you try and find someone. Well, we are speaking to people now that may be interested in putting in some money. I can't say who it is, but it would be a nice thought that someone would come in and we'd be, you know, be able to carry on doing it.
And finally, there's a question we ask everyone who comes on the show. It's kind of the sort of fantasy question. If you were in charge of the ICC, what would be your first move?
God, if I was in charge of the ICC, I'd probably get rid of 50-over cricket. I'd shorten the World Cup. But the World Cup for me would be more like a Champions Trophy. We're going to cover the World Cup in Australia next year. It's going to be, what, 60 days? It's going to be Kenya playing Canada. You know, as much, I don't mind those teams playing, but I think that the one thing that the lesser nations have to do, and I will probably make a second tier, actually, test championship, because I do think it's important to bring new people into the first-class test arena. And with teams falling away like the West Indies over the years, it got worse. You know, Pakistan a bit troublesome, can be good, can be bad. You know, Bangladesh, where are they? So I think it's worth having a second-tier system and a playoff system, first division, second division, that kind of thing. It would be quite interesting in world cricket. It would maybe buck the ideas up of the lower teams and create new competition.
To the debate, and this week's topic is inspired by a piece by Andy Bull on the Guardian website, which talks about the way that the end of cricket on free-to-air TV after the 2005 Ashes has had a detrimental effect on the game. So this episode, we're going to be debating whether things will ever be as good as 2005.
It's become accepted amongst cricket fans as basically a truism that that 2005 series was the greatest test series in terms of the quality of cricket. But what the Andy Bull piece is very strong on is the fact that it was where cricket sat in the national psyche that made 2005 significant. It was the national sport. It was a focus of debate. It was something that all, you know, communities, workplaces were rallying around. And I think what I found striking about the piece and find hard to disagree with is it's very, very hard to imagine cricket ever being in that position again. Obviously, free-to-air is a big part of it, but I actually, sadly, I think it's more than that. I think there's obviously the huge competition from other sports going on. I think it's an ongoing issue with trying to get test cricket into, not just, you know, in terms of where it sits with cricket fans, but into the general public as a whole. And it was quite a striking thought, because you think, if the cricket's good, maybe it would reclaim its place. But you're actually thinking it may never get back to that place in terms of the public opinion.
I mean, I think there are two things. One of which is the means through which the game is transmitted to the public. Basically, you know, the structures and the, you know, the media and things like that, which actually enable the public to interact with the game. And then the other one is the game per se. Now, this whole debate reminds me of quite a lot of debate that happened in the tennis world around, you know, so there was sort of the Sampras era, and then cricket, and then tennis had a little bit of a fallow period until basically Federer and Nadal came along, and suddenly everyone wanted to watch tennis. And basically the reason for that was, as much as anything, because the tennis was so brilliant and it was so competitive, and there was just this story and this narrative behind it that everyone would follow. And that's what always slightly annoys me about pieces like Andy Bull's piece, because it's kind of, well, yes, absolutely, there has to be a means for the game to be transmitted. But at the same time, I would defy anyone. I mean, everyone always says 2005 is, you know, the greatest test series. And the reason for that isn't that it was on free-to-air TV. The reason for that is because the cricket was bloody good.
I guess the question, this will come down, if a series was as good as that again, would it be able to reclaim its place? And I think I have to say I'm slightly swayed by Bill's argument that I think it's seeing harder and harder to do that. I think the other thing that made 2005 very, very special was there was a sense that England had fallen out of love with cricket. Our team had been so useless for such a long time. Mm. I mean, you know, the turnaround obviously didn't happen overnight in 2005. We'd been rebuilding for a few years. But to actually compete and beat the Australians was something that, you know, for people of our age was unprecedented. And I guess it's hard to recreate that thrill. It's an odd way of putting it, but you almost need the fallow period to then have the redemptive ending.
It's the thrill, and I think it's the mythical way in which we... Well, both mythical and not mythical way in which we treat heroes. So the iconic image of that summer was obviously Freddie Flintoff, arms up in the air, you know, all doing his pose, that whole thing. And here was someone who was very much, you know, a Lancashire lad, you know, he enjoyed a few beers down the pub. He occasionally, you know, turned up at the number 10 Downing Street, horribly hungover, and actually probably not hungover, probably just still drunk. And we were kind of willing to forgive him all that, and actually it sort of endeared him to us, and, you know, it was kind of, oh, lads, he's one of us. You fast forward to now, and the cricketer who, you know, and we said we weren't going to discuss him again, but the cricketer who kind of is at the heart of the sort of English cricket experience, in a sense, ironically, at the moment, is Kevin Peterson, who we are all just so cynical about, essentially, and has just turned into this very explicit PR-driven media fanfare.
There does seem to be more of a reluctance on the part of us as fans and the media as a whole to accept heroes at face value, basically. And I do wonder whether that's just a phase we're going through, because there is certainly a feeling that post-KP, that relationship between the England cricket team and the fans hasn't been great. And even, you know, this summer's victory over India doesn't quite seem to have repaired that. So perhaps we are just going through a phase. Perhaps, you know, change in personnel, once this KP thing is left behind, maybe we can get back to that point.
I mean, and it does. You kind of think that the... sort of this whole debacle around English cricket at the moment is kind of in a sense equivalent to the whole debacle that happened in the 1990s about us having no idea what end of the bat to pick up and something like that. And so exactly as you say, sometimes there is that kind of need for a fallow period and then everyone gets excited. It's not reasonable to expect everyone to remain as excited about cricket as everyone was in 2005.